I'm Rachel Newton.
And I'm Lauren McCall. Welcome to the Heal and Harrow podcast.
The 16th and 17th century Scottish witch trials were one of the darkest periods of Scotland's history. An estimated 2,500 people, mostly women, were executed and many more accused. With Heal and Harrow, we seek to pay a humanising tribute to these women while also exploring historical beliefs in the supernatural and modern-day parallels in our society today.
Our project takes the form of an album and a live show. The music is based on specially commissioned works by celebrated author Mary Kidd, tales inspired by and in remembrance of real women who were persecuted and tried as witches, and characters from the folkloric tales and mythology enshrined in our oral culture. These stories form part of her brilliant book, We Are All Witches.
In this podcast, we discuss the woman who inspired the work, Mary's writing process, and how we went about creating our musical response. We'll also hear excerpts from the stories themselves, read by 10 brilliant women from across Scotland.
Do click the subscribe button to make sure you catch each episode as soon as it's released. And if you would like to rate and review, that would be much appreciated as it really helps us reach more ears. You can find links to purchase our album, Mary's book, and download the story readings in full at healandharrow.com.
This week's episode is Cutty Sark, read by musician and actor Annie Grace. Here's Mary to tell us more about Cutty Sark.
So Nanny probably doesn't need a huge amount of introduction. She is Nanny from Robert Burns's great poem Tam O'Shanter. And for those of you listening who are not familiar with Tam O'Shanter, Tam is a drunkard who has failed to heed his wife's good advice about cawing canny while out on the lash and air on market day. And as he rides home on his horse Meg, he sees lights glimmering out of this ruined kirk. And he kind of hears mirth and dancing and creeps closer. He sees this witch's Sabbath going on. They're having a high old time. All the coffins are open and all the corpses have got a candle in their hands. And as Tam watches, he sees this young woman. And of course, this is the Cutty Sark. She's in a short shift. All the women dancing have got hot, thrown off their clothes. And they're linking at it in their sarks, as he says. And Burns says his muse can't describe Nanny, you know, how she flings herself around. And the comment I always love is a supple George, she was and strang. And Tam watches and, of course, cries out, well done, Cutty Sark. He gets excited and the witches follow him out and chase him to the brig. And his poor horse Maggie loses her tail as they cross the running water that the witches can't cross. And I thought, you know, in a way, she's the most iconic witch in Scottish literature, if not Scottish history. And I just needed some lightness after the general misery of all of these dead women, murdered in horrible ways, judicially murdered in horrible ways. And so I thought, well, actually, how could I spin Tam O'Shanter and Nanny? And I thought, what if Nanny was just a wee lassie who's having a silly evening with her pals? And you know what teenagers can be like with their Ouija boards at parties and all the kind of fascination with the occult. I think there's a little bit of a goth in every teenager. And so, you know, that's what Nanny's got into. They're just having a laugh. She's outgrown her sark because her granny has given her this awful woolen sark. She's so upset because it cost so much money. Burns tells us it was twop on Scots, 'twas all riches. So poor Nanny is stuck in this awful shift, a woolen undergarment to be worn next to the skin. And then, of course, along comes Tam O'Shanter and gets it all wrong. And the next thing is their fun is all spoiled. So it's just a kind of a game with all the bits of the poem. And it was just a joy after the misery of everything else.
I was rereading this before this episode and I just was laughing so much at this story. I just think it's brilliant. It's so funny. And that subversion of the tale and seeing it from her perspective and just the way she kind of shoots down all of these, you know, all of these kind of fantastical notions from the Tam O'Shanter story. And she just shoots them all down and explains them away in such a funny kind of matter-of-fact teenage way. And this innocence and freedom that she has as a young person is just so refreshing, and it's great. It's such a joy to read. And yeah, who hasn't, as a teenager, spent a night with their friends?
trying to contact the dead.
Yeah, it's that idea of young girls coming together and just being silly, which is every young girl's right to be able to do that. It's just lovely to see that happening in a way that she's unharmed.
And I mean, I had so much fun thinking of it. So for example, you know, as you'll know, in Tam O'Shanter, a Winnet Bunker in the East, there sat old Nick in the Shape of Beast. And actually, it's just a lad playing the pipes. And she's sort of horrified at what Tam said afterwards. You could do with getting his eyebrows under control, but he hardly looks like old Nick. And it was just, all that was just kind of joyful. And it also lets you see that, you know, teenagers would have been teenagers. People had fun. Actually, Tam O'Shanter is a very fun poem. You know, Tam's hanging out with Kurt and Jean and drinking himself silly with her. So you think, well, actually, these women have some freedom.
Nanny. I've always hated that name. I see myself more as an Anna. An Anna could be a belle, could marry a lawyer maybe, or a doctor, or an army captain. Perhaps an Anna could even be a woman of substance in her own right. A thinker, a writer. A nanny? Well, at best a blacksmith's wife, at worst a goat. Mother's sister was called Anna. She ran off to join Elspeth Buchan down at Closeburn when I was a child. We don't speak of her at home. Granny makes sure of that. But I know what they believe, that crowd. Everybody does. They believe that Elspeth Buchan is a saint, even though it's clear to anyone with eyes that she's nothing more than a fat fraud from somewhere in the northeast, with sweat stains on her bodice and dirty feet. Auntie Anna and her fellow fools once fasted on Buchan's say-so for 40 nights and 40 days because they believed it would make them light enough to be lifted up to heaven by the angels. She's a big woman, Auntie Anna. Wouldn't fancy the angels' chances. We're all well-built, the women folk in our family, made for living on farms, helping her husband stoop the harvest or haul a calf out of its mother when things go wrong. So, no chance my family would ever call me Anna after Auntie Anna's transgression. It's Nanny all the way for me. Granny's an Effie, Euphemia, the very image of respectability and holiness. And when they were pouring out the milk of human kindness, Granny didn't get her fair share. The woman would as soon take a hairbrush to your legs as cuddle you. I was feared of her when I was young, and she never let me forget that I was a sinner. And by the time I was 13, I was a bundle of panic, convinced I was bound for hell. My sins were not so many looking back now. But then I would have said I was a liar. I once denied all knowledge of a broken jar of sugar. A blasphemer, in my head mainly, and vainer than any Jezebel. And on this latter count, you see, I had fallen in love with a dress. It hung in the window of a dressmaker's house in the village, white and yellow striped cotton with a fine green edging, and I coveted it as I had never coveted anything before. It was £2 Scots, more money than I could ever imagine having in my possession. I was about to turn 14 then, and my monthly bleeding had just begun. Perhaps Granny was moved by the fact her last grandchild was so nearly grown, for she said she wished to buy me something special to mark the day of my birth. Something to wear, she said, as soon I might wish to go out among people and I would need something decent to wrap myself in. I was in raptures. It must be the dress. I didn't sleep the night before my birthday, I was that excited, and by the time my parents and Granny had risen and breakfasted, I was fit to be tied, And finally Granny handed me the bundle and I almost tore it apart to find... the Paisley Sark. That's right. My very own full-length woolen woman's undergarment in Paisley pattern. I don't know about you, but nothing says wear me against your skin to me better than a nice thick woolly shift. And as Granny said, a woolen sark is always useful. You can wear it under your frock on a cold day, sleep in it, and if the worst happens, you can be laid out in it and wear it for all eternity. On the Day of Judgment, Granny said, I could be proud to stand before my Maker in that sark. I've already said she was a fell religious woman, and you can make up your own mind about her approach to dressing for big occasions. I'll admit I was less than gracious about my gift. Mother wormed her hand under my arm and pinched me hard.
What,
Bonnie, Mother, she said to Granny.
Is it no Bonnie, Nanny?
Bonnie, I said as enthusiastically as I could. Granny looked gratified.
12 pound Scots yon cost me, she said. 'Twas all my riches.
I could have grat. And maybe I would have if I'd realised then that that pointed wee comment about the cost would mean that I would be expected to wear the bloody thing for at least another decade.
At one point in his life, Burns had a run-in, in a sense, with a female, which wasn't a witch in any way, she wasn't accused of being a witch, but she was a sort of female religious leader in the sense that she set up a cult, a woman called Elspeth Buchan, who was from the Buchan area of the country, and she kind of moved around Scotland and set up with this minister, essentially their own little cult. They were a bit of a doomsday cult, and they were down Robert Burns's way. The Buchanites, as they called themselves, believed that there was about to be a day of reckoning and Elspeth Buchan would pull them all up to heaven by the topknot. Like they'd have a ponytail and she'd pull them. I don't know what they were to do if they were bald, but she was going to lift them up to heaven that way. There's all sorts of really bizarre things that they did. So, for example, they fasted a lot so that Elspeth Buchan would be able to lift them. But Elspeth Buchan herself was quite a solid lady by all accounts and she didn't bother fasting. So obviously she was the chosen one. But Burns fell foul of her. Burns, obviously, you know, he was a man for the ladies and he fell for this girl called Jean Gardner. And Jean Gardner was one of the Buchanites. And I think there was a bit of an ultimatum. And Robert Burns wrote a lot of very unpleasant things about Elspeth Buchan, which you can only suspect were probably quite well deserved. And Jean Gardner forsook Robbie. Robbie's charms were not enough. And she stuck with Elspeth Buchan. You know, and the rest is history. The Buchanites kind of just disappear from history when Elspeth dies. So, yeah, Robbie met one of those rare Scottish female religious leaders in his era.
Fascinating
very unlucky story
for Robbie.
I like to think lucky for Jean Gardner, given that Robbie was so very good at getting all of his conquests pregnant.
Yes.
And then taking home all of these poor illegitimate children to be brought up by poor old Jean Armour, the yes. most long-suffering of all.
When I was 15, I sprouted, so my legs stuck out from the sark like stalks of parsley. Mother let down my two dresses as best she could, but still my ankles jutted out, bony and gangly. Granny tutted at me and said it wasn't natural for a lass to grow so tall. And that's how I got into the witching. I was desperate to stop growing, and my pal Helen said that old wife Morton's niece Mary would give me a charm for it. I went and asked her one day when Mother had no need of me and Mary laughed at me. What old thou I would hae a thing like thon, she asked. Abody says thou is a witch, says I. I was no dissembler at that point of my life. Oh, come to the kirk, says she then. The morn's nicht at full moon. I stole out of the house when the rest were asleep and walked to Alloway Kirk. I was a wee bitty nervous, to tell the truth, for it was a cloudy night and there was precious little moonlight to see by. I had no fancy to be jumped on by some bogle or worse, some randy old fool like Willie Fisher. I had no idea either what Mary might want me to do when I reached the kirk. And it turned out she mainly wanted to introduce me to her pals, who said they were a coven of witches and giggled a lot. They sat in a circle and passed round a bottle of rosehip wine and talked about lads that had caught their eye. And then they played a sort of game where they asked a question and cast a ruckle of wee bones down in the ground and then tried to divine what was meant by the pattern in which they fell. You know the sort of thing. I'll wager you've been at least once to a party where someone has asked the spirits for guidance. The answers they got seemed to me mainly to be the ones they wanted. Towards the end, there was a spat as two lassies had an eye on the same lad, and each lass maintained the bones were saying she would have him. All was made up in the end, though, and there was some singing before we all wound our way tipsily back home, only to rise bleary-eyed and wabbit not 2 hours later. We'd arranged the next meeting before we left at full moon the next month. This time, Mary said we'd meet in the kirk itself and we'd have a dance. Ugh, she was full of plans to dress the old place up with bones and cobwebs and all sorts. That was Mary all over, you know the type, in love with the idea of darkness and drama.
It was great to read this when you first sent it, because it was one of the later ones that you sent, and obviously we'd been getting your stories back, and like you say, we're just so much in that darkness of the whole topic, and given that we hadn't seen you in person, and then you just get this email with a story, and it's just got so much of your humour. You're a very funny person, so when you're writing about these dark things, there's quite often like little things that we might know because we know you, little kind of Mariisms or things that come through, you know. But for you to kind of have a bit more freedom in order to do that, because you're writing a comical piece, it's great and it's lovely to see that.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it. So we needed it, didn't we? We just needed a bit of a break.
And that actually comes across quite a lot in the gig. So for anyone who's seen the Hale and Harrow show, or you maybe yet to see it, we usually play it in the order of the album and indeed in the order of this podcast. So by this time in the gig, a little bit of light is needed, not just musically, but in terms of the visuals, which we've touched on a little bit before, but Alison Piper, who did the visuals for us, a lot of what she created as well was in response to the intensity of the music and the story. So she chose as well to go quite far away from that with the visuals for this piece, which is largely sourced from Scottish Screen Archive and is essentially a few minutes of footage of women having fun, and largely younger women. And it usually gets quite a good laugh from the audience because they're needing that little bit of light as well. And it's the first time that you also see women on screen in the show, because everything else is very abstract, very elemental imagery. So it's a real turning point in the gig in lots of ways.
And Lauren's tune that you wrote for it, that feels really joyful and it feels like a dance tune. In the studio, we had these two ideas, didn't we? That were so different. You know, we had that sort of dance tune and then we had this, I don't even know what you'd call it, me mucking around on Ableton software and making a kind of riff, I don't know. And we wanted to use it in some way, but we weren't sure how to kind of meld the two. And then we had this idea for a song to kind of go over the top of that section, but the transition from one to the next felt quite impossible at one point. And then somehow we kind of made it work, but it's got a strange kind of feeling of slightly like the time signature changes, doesn't it? And it makes you feel a little bit like you've kind of fallen off your axis a little bit.
Thank you.
yeah, I suppose that kind of idea of Tam O'Shanter's perspective of this is all getting really weird. And, you know, and his imaginings. I always, even before this, when I've thought of Tam O'Shanter, I've thought of it in quite a kind of psychedelic or something way. You know, the way that Burns describes Tam O'Shanter's experience, and that, you know, he's obviously had a few drinks. And so, yeah, kind of that idea of slightly being off your axis, sort of musically, I think. And then the vocals coming in and being quite affected. And there's quite a lot of them. We sort of layered up. There's three kind of harmonies, but lots of layers of those harmonies. So it feels kind of like there's a group of girls sort of singing together, which felt important. And yeah, we took the words from the Tam O'Shanter poem, which I could read the translation, because there might be some people that have got the album that might not understand the kind of Scots language. So yeah, the translation, which is quite, I find it quite amusing in itself. As Thomas glowered amazed and curious, the mirth and fun grew fast and furious. The piper loud and louder blew. The dancers quick and quicker flew. They reeled, they set, they crossed, they linked, till every witch sweated and smelled and cast her ragged clothes to the floor and danced deftly at it in her underskirts. I just find that translation quite hilarious.
It's a very funny translation, isn't it? I also don't imagine your sark either as being an underskirt. I imagine that being rather more the top bit.
It made me laugh reading that.
Do you remember, Rachel, because I am very old and briefly taught Rachel drama when she was at primary school. Do you remember that you were, I think, at school with a couple of, well, kids then, adults now, whose parents had a puppet theatre and they did the most unbelievably brilliant Tam O'Shanter. It was just gorgeous. And I think of it as quite psychedelic because it was really brightly coloured and brilliantly lit. Do you remember that?
I do. And I think that's, in fact, I was thinking about that earlier, and I think that's why I've got that. That's my image of Tam O'Shanter, because that is definitely my reference point from being a kid. And Kim and Simon McIntyre, their incredible puppet show, which, yeah, it was one of those things that you see as a child and it really has such an impact. And that definitely did. I just thought that was brilliant. Really great.
Same for me, and I was seeing it as a young adult. I'm going to get that young in there because I was very young.
You were very young.
I was only a student.
So there we were, having the illicit time of our lives when that drunken sot O'Shanter keeked in the window. I suppose it's funny in a way, but at the time I thought it would put Peter fun, and I was a bit sore. What he said about us after, though, it did tickle me. But let's take the opportunity to set the record straight. Old Nick was not in attendance, whatever you've heard. It's dark up there at the Winnock Bunker, and O'Shanter was drunk. It's funny, really, that he saw Jamie Dunlop on the pipes and mistook him for the devil. I mean, Jamie's an unkempt chiel, especially his eyebrows, but in shape a beast? I think that's a bit mean. Nor was the altar strewn with evidence of murder and mayhem. Five scimitars with murder crusted, indeed. How many houses round the town of Ayr contain a scimitar, may I ask you? I'll warrant it's many fewer than five. Tomahawks likewise. We have few American natives here. And supposedly there were all sorts else too. A garter which a babe had strangled, a knife a father's throat had mangled. Tell me, how can a man look on a knife and know it has done a murder? He even looked at the ox tongue Christina Smith had brought for her dinner and said it was a lawyer's tongue, turned inside out. The garter was Betty Dunlop's, and she had taken it off in a most scandalous manner. They were all worldly wise young ladies, Mary's pals, and I felt out of place amongst them, a parsley-legged stripling of 15. I had no knowledge of Jezebel dancing and flirting with men, and so that's when I hit on my plan. After one dance, it was a reel, I fanned myself ostentatiously and said I thought I might faint. "Loosen your bodice," said Mary. "I'll do better than that,"
says me, and I stripped off my old dress, so I stood there in the paisley sack. It looked quite the racy number then, with my long white legs poking out the thigh. There was a great cheering then, and everybody else was soon casting off their own skirts and bodices. We got back to the dancing, and it was a wild sight. All those legs and bubbies bouncing and jostling about in time to the tune. The dirty bugger at the window had his hands on his breeches, I'll wager. It was me in particular that had caught his eye, it seems, for right when we were in the midst of the Strip the Willow, my favourite of all the dances, although the curt was narrow for it, he cried out something about my cutty sark. The music stopped then, and we all ran after him, and the sump lumbered away and onto his horse. I'm a good runner with my long legs, and I nearly caught him. The others whooped and howled, but as he reached the old brig, half of his horse's tail came away in my hand. It must have had the mange, the poor beast. When he'd gone, we thought we'd better pack up. We had no doubt that it would be the end of our fun in Alloway Kirk once the story got about. But Jamie said he knew a place out by the shore at Carrick where we could meet the next month. I could hardly wait. Ah, it's a fine thing to be young. Oh, the next day, I took O'Shanter's wife Kate an ointment for the mange. I felt bad about the horse, and it's Kate's horse really. It's a nice beast, and Kate's a nice woman. Not her fault her husband's a peeping Tom and a pervert.
Listening to the Heal and Harrow podcast, produced by us, Heal and Harrow, and recorded and edited by Grant Anderson. All the music you heard is from our self-titled album, with thanks to Mary Kidd and Annie Grace.
You can buy our album, a copy of Mary's book We Are All Witches, and hear the stories in full by visiting healandharrow.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to rate, review and subscribe so you won't miss an episode. Bye for now.